In early January, the UN Food and Agricultural Organization reported that its food price index had reached an all-time high in December, exceeding the previous record set during the 2000-2008 price surge. But even more alarming, on February 3rd, the organization, the FAO, the Food and Agricultural Organization, announced that the December record had been broken in January as prices climbed an additional 3%. According to today's guest, Lester Brown, founder of World Watch and the Earth Policy Institute, and the author of World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse, quote, if the world has a poor harvest this year, food prices will rise to previously unimaginable levels. Food riots will multiply, political unrest will spread, and governments will fall. The world is now one poor harvest away from chaos in world grain markets. We're in big trouble. Our earth and our economy are in crisis. Essentially, we've created a bubble economy in which we're overconsuming the earth's natural resources. Nowhere is this more evident than in the food sector, where record high temperatures and falling water tables are causing food production to decline. Most visible is the shrinking world grain harvest, which has been inflated by overpumping aquifers, a practice that virtually guarantees a future drop in production when aquifers are depleted, and thus the notion of a bubble. In his new book, World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse, Brown lays out the symptoms, the diagnosis, and the cure, what he calls Plan B. He estimates that we could solve all the world's greatest problems for $200 billion a year, less than a third of the U.S. defense budget. But it will take an all-out response at wartime speed proportionate to the magnitude of the threats facing civilization. Plan B is a comprehensive plan for reversing the trends that are undermining our future. Its four overriding goals are stabilize climate, stabilize population, eradicate poverty, and restore the Earth's damaged ecosystems. And Lester Brown says failure to reach any one of these goals will likely mean failure to reach the others as well. You can learn more at earthpolicy, one word, earthpolicy.org, where you can also download the entire book. Lester Brown has been described by the Washington Post as one of the world's most influential thinkers. After working with the Department of Agriculture and International Agricultural Development, he helped establish the Overseas Development Council. Then he founded World Watch Institute, which plays an important role in the public's understanding of trends with its annual State of the World report and Vital Signs. In 2001, he left World Watch, founded Earth Policy Institute, and continues his vital work. During a career that began with tomato farming, Brown has been honored with numerous prizes, including the MacArthur Genius Fellowship, the United Nations Environment Prize, and Japan's Blue Planet Prize, along with at least 20 honorary degrees. Welcome back, Lester Brown.
Terrence, it's my pleasure. Let me just give you one update. You
sure.
The FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization, the UN, reporting a record food prices in December that was broken in January. It has now been broken in February. Just a few days ago, they announced that February food prices jumped by another 2%.
Oh, my God.
So we're on a real roll here.
Yeah. I mean, when you start talking 3%, 2% a month, that's anyone think about it. 2% is 24% in a year. 3% is 36%, so it's over 25-30% in a year for food. And let's jump right into this. We'll get into, you know, we're going to circle around a lot of things in the hour, but let's get right into this. One of the things that it's my observation, and it's not something you hear everywhere, is that this spike in food prices has a lot to do with what's going on in the Middle East right now. My understanding, and I'm going to throw this out to you and then let you pick it up, is that in America, when basic food commodity prices go up percentage points, we don't notice it nearly as much because so much of our food prices are made up in packaging, advertising, marketing, so that the actual cost of the contents of that bread or that cereal is masked, and so not as big a deal. But in countries where the actual price of the grain is most of the price of the food, these rises are pushing people to starvation. And the fellow who started the Tunisian uprising with his self-immolation, I believe, couldn't find a job, but also was basically protesting food prices.
He was actually a food vendor who was being abused by the police, and they took his food wagon with the food on it away from him, and he was just so enraged by that that he set himself on fire, and in the process launched who knows how many political revolutions in the Middle East, three major ones to date. The point about price rises, grain price rises, affecting people in developing countries much more than they do us is well taken. Let me just point out that when I buy a $2 loaf of wheat bread, whole wheat bread in the local supermarket here, it contains about 10 cents worth of wheat. If the price of wheat doubles, it adds 10 cents to the price of the loaf of bread, so it goes from $2 to $2.10. Well, that's not a big deal. But if you live in northern India or in Pakistan and you go to the market and buy wheat as wheat, bring it home, grind it into a coarse flour and make chapatis, if the price of wheat doubles, the price of your bread effectively doubles. And that is the big difference, because we are so isolated by so much processing, marketing, transportation, and advertising and so forth, that we don't feel the effect of rising food prices nearly as directly as do people in the developing countries.
So my guess is a book, even a book that in some sense, I noticed that, you know, you come out with a book basically early, almost every year, and it kind of updates given what's happened in commodities, what's happened in environmental reports, what's happened in politics and economics and so on. But even a book like that takes several months to produce. How much has changed since you even began this? This latest book.
Well, we began it before the heat wave in Russia.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
For example, and that heat wave. I mean, if someone had told me at this time last year that there would be a heat wave in Russia and that the average temperature in Moscow for the month of July would be 14 degrees above normal, I would have said, you know, I'm not a climate denier, but that's pushing things a bit far. I mean, a 4-degree rise in the average temperature for a month over the norm is a lot, if you know.
Yeah.
It all. This is 14 degrees. And it's no wonder that the country, you know, after 6 weeks of this, by early August, was burning out of control. I mean, there were 300 or 400 new fires starting every day. Things are so dry and so vulnerable to fire. I mean, the Russians simply could not control what was happening. And in the end, it cost them about $300 billion.
$300 billion.
That's roughly triple the damage from Katrina.
Yeah, and a country much poorer than ours.
Yes.
Yeah, and they also, if I'm not mistaken, stopped exporting grain?
Because domestic food prices began to rise so rapidly in the face of what was obviously going to be a disastrous harvest, the government banned exports. One of the ironies of this, in thinking about political revolutions in the Middle East, is that a year ago, Egypt negotiated a 5-year agreement. Egypt, which is the world's largest wheat importer, negotiated a 5-year agreement with the Russians to provide them with 3 million tons of wheat per year. They wanted to nail down part of their imports so they wouldn't be quite so nervous about being able to get enough grain. Well, the ink was hardly dry on that agreement. I mean, within a few months, the Russians announced that they were going to ban all grain exports, including the wheat they had committed to Egypt.
So one can follow these events and see how they contribute to the enormous changes that are happening. I know that you and I must have talked three, four years ago about the beginnings of this food issue. And when we talk about a food issue, we're really talking to a great extent about a water issue in most countries, and in the U.S. about a water and energy issue. I don't think that's quite so true in so many other countries that have less energy-intensive agriculture. But as you've been watching this, my guess is that things have accelerated on all these fronts faster than even you anticipated.
Things are tightening, and we focused on the heat wave in Russia, but in a sense, the world was fortunate, because if that heat wave that was centered in Moscow had been centered instead in Chicago, instead of the world losing 40% of Russia's grain harvest of roughly 100 million tons or 40 million tons, if we had lost 40% of our grain harvest of 400 million tons, that would have been 160 million tons. A loss on that scale would have dropped world grain stocks to the lowest level on record. It would take us where we've never been before. And that would have led to rises in grain prices that would have gone not a doubling or tripling, but literally off the top of the chart. Food prices would have been rising everywhere, and we would have seen exporting countries doing exactly what the Russians did, that is, restrict, either banning or limiting exports in order to keep their food prices down internally. The next thing that would have happened is that the oil exporting countries that import grain, which is most of them, would have begun to barter oil for grain in order to make sure they got the grain they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And that would not have left a lot of grain for the rest of the world, particularly the other grain importing countries with relatively low income. So we could have seen, instead of watching smoke in Moscow and fires burning in the Russian countryside, we could have been watching food riots on a scale we've not seen before in country after country around the world, and we could have seen the a number of governments falling simply because they would not have had any way of responding adequately to their people's dependence on imported grain.
So let me just double back on one thing you said. In other words, a country that has a coveted resource that it can exchange for grain is in one position, but countries that lack that coveted resource, whether it be oil or oil in most cases, but is the ones that would just face starvation.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not a pretty picture, but it's an indication of how close we are to the edge now, and I don't think most people fully realize it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I speak to people, you know, all around, and it does seem that they do not make these linkages.
Right. You asked the question about water before I interrupted this with the Moscow versus Chicago example, but there are now 18 countries in the world where there is a water-based food bubble, that is, countries where grain production has been inflated by overpumping aquifers. And when those aquifers are depleted, the rate of pumping will necessarily be reduced to the rate of recharge, and grain production will be reduced accordingly. The most dramatic example we've seen of a bursting bubble so far, and there have only been a few, has been in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
The Saudis decided a long time ago, after the oil export embargo of the 70s, that they would be vulnerable to a counter grain export embargo. So to offset that, they used their old drilling technology, and they found an aquifer about a half mile down that they've been pumping ever since then. And they've been self-sufficient in wheat production for more than 20 years. But that aquifer is not a replenishable aquifer, as most aquifers are. That aquifer was a fossil aquifer. So once it was pumped out, that was it. And so I think it was 3 years ago now, in early 2008, they announced that the aquifer was largely depleted and they would be phasing out wheat production over the next 8 years. Actually, the phase-out has come much faster. In 3 years, they've lost over 70% of their grain production. And in another year or two, they will be totally dependent on the imported grain.
So let me, because I, you know, it's easy to sort of, I'm imagining a listener hears a couple of phrases and sort of, okay, I got this as a problem. But I want to go back and shine a little more light on a couple of the things we're talking about here, because I don't see them being talked about or written about elsewhere. One is, let's just talk about the difference between a surface aquifer and a fossil aquifer, or a replenishable aquifer and a fossil aquifer. How did that really happen? What does that mean?
Right. Most aquifers are replenishable aquifers. You know, if you have a well at your house, you're probably pumping from a replenishable aquifer. And as long as you don't pump too much, there will always be water there. And replenishable aquifers are recharged by rainfall, by water percolating down into the aquifer to constantly recharge it. But some aquifers were created through geological activity, you know, eons ago, and water was trapped underground. So it's been there for millions and millions of years. And that's the kind of aquifer that the Saudis were pumping from. There was no recharge for that aquifer.
In other words, water got trapped, you stick a well into it, you pump it up, and when you empty that aquifer, it's done. And you're saying basically Saudi Arabia has been living off that aquifer at an unreplenishable aquifer for years.
That's right.
And more, I believe there's a fossil aquifer under much of the plains of the U.S. as well?
That's right. There are two major fossil aquifers in the world. One is the Ogallala Aquifer, the aquifer that underlies the western Great Plains from Nebraska south of the Texas Panhandle. That is a largely fossil aquifer. It gets a little recharge once in a while, but it's mostly fossil. And so if you fly from Denver to New York or Washington, or if you fly from here in Washington to Denver, the last better part of an hour of the flight, you'll see these crop circles in the ground. Those circles are center pivot irrigation systems, and in the center of each of them is a well that's pumping water from underground. And that water is coming from, in most cases, from the Ogallala Aquifer, the western part of that aquifer. And in some places, the aquifer was not very thick to begin with, like the Texas Panhandle, and it's been mostly pumped dry, and farmers in northern Texas have gone back to dry land farming, which they can do there, but the wheat yields would only be about half as high. So Texas, along with California, two of our leading agricultural states, have both lost quite a bit of irrigated land over the last decade or so because they're of a loss of irrigation water. In Texas, mostly from the aquifer being depleted in California, partly because of diversion of irrigation water to cities.
Right, yes. Yeah, there are all of these factors at play, and one of them is the water is diminishing while the population that wants water is increasing. I'm speaking with Lester Brown, author of World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse, and you can learn more at Earth Policy, one word, earthpolicy.org. One other thing that I really found myself thinking as I was reading this section on this water bubble is years ago when I was actually working with the Natural Step, an organization you I'm sure are aware of. The key message in what they were talking about was that when the flows are in balance, in that case, they were talking about the flows often of heavy metals, for instance, mm-hmm. From the Earth's crust up and the Earth's crust down. As long as they were in balance, things were fine. But we have knocked them way out of balance over years and over the last century, and that leads to a lot of our pollution and public health problems. I see exactly the same thing here again. In other words, we find a technology that allows us to temporarily exceed nature's balance.
Mm-hmm.
And then we live off that for a while. But there's basically that lesson that the flows that nature that have persisted in nature for whatever, hundreds of thousands, millions of years, those are the safe flows. Those are the safe rates.
That's right. The disturbing thing about the overpumping of aquifers is that it is so widespread, and the 18 countries where there are water-based food bubbles, some of which are starting to burst, as has happened quite dramatically in the last few years in Saudi Arabia, but those 18 countries contain over half the world's people, and they include both India and China. In India, the World Bank reports that 175 million Indians are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. Our estimate for China is 130 million Chinese being fed with grain produced from overpumping. Now, overpumping is by definition a short-term phenomenon. And so the question is, as these as aquifers are depleted and the rate of pumping is necessarily reduced to the rate of recharge and these food bubbles are eliminated, where do the governments go to get the food to replace that was produced by overpumping? And that's a question that we're going to be reckoning with fairly soon, I think, as China, which is now having trouble expanding its grain harvest, begins to turn to the outside world for massive quantities of grain. And when it does that, it will necessarily come to the U.S. because we totally dominate world grain exports. We export as much grain as the next three countries put together. So for Americans for whom cheap food is sort of part of our birthright, we may be in for a surprise soon, because if 1.4 billion Chinese with rapidly rising incomes come into our market competing with us for our grain harvest, we're going to see much higher food prices. And historically, faced with something like this, we would have restricted exports. I remember in the 1970s, we even banned soybean exports to Japan, though we were the sole supplier. But we can't do that with China, because China is our banker.
That's right.
As you probably know, every month here in Washington, the Treasury Department auctions off U.S. Treasury securities. And the purpose of that is to cover our fiscal deficit. And the Chinese are one of the big buyers. They now hold roughly $1 trillion. That's $1,000 billion worth of Treasury securities. They are our banker. And there's a limit to what you can say to your banker.
That's right. In other words, I've long been worried, you know, what if they decide that that for whatever combination of reasons, including not being able to trust American financial markets based on, you know, some of the machinations of the recent crash and so on, or any number of things, if they make decisions that we're not as sound an investment, we could be in trouble. And I had never factored in this one, that at the point at which they say we want your grain, they're gonna get it. And what you're saying is we'll feel the shock in prices. Let me ask a question now that we're beginning to get into that place where economics and nature overlap. What is the role of speculation in some of what's happening to food prices? That is to say, everyone who ever listens to the commodities numbers on the air, you know, you'll hear, you know, pork bellies, corn, wheat, oil, etc. And it used to be a hedge for farmers against bad weather, against a bad harvest. But speculation has moved into that territory. What's your take on the role it's playing these days?
There, There is speculation. There's no question about it. But speculation really becomes important only when prices are rising and commodities become scarce, whether it's oil or copper or wheat or what have you. And with grain, for example, there's also when prices start to rise, country governments begin to feel insecure. And so they like to buy some extra in order to sort of build up their internal reserves. Now, is that speculation? In a sense, it is. They're anticipating that prices may get higher and they may get things may get tight and they won't have enough. So those sort of things happen. And there clearly are investors who simply speculate in the market, but they're really successful only when prices are moving very fast, either up or down. And lately, that's been up. So
in other words, adding up what you're just saying is, at the point where speculation can do the most damage is when it's most likely to become a factor.
That's right.
So that as prices are going up because of natural factors, weather, water, and so on, that is when it becomes an attractive market to play in.
That's right. And and we're also seeing this now in with land and these so-called land grabs by either government corporations of importing countries like Saudi Arabia or China or South Korea, to cite three of the better-known examples. These countries are beginning to acquire land in other countries to produce food for themselves. And they not only are acquiring land, but also water. Now, initially, these land acquisitions, which have become quite substantial now, were initiated by governments who were worried about not being able to get enough food from the world market if things tightened up, and so they wanted to be producing some of their own. That has now been joined by speculators in land value.
Oh, my.
And so now we're seeing investment banks and wealthy individuals, agribusiness corporations, acquiring land, not necessarily because they plan to use it to produce food, but just to hang on to it. As someone said, land is the new gold rush, because people are beginning to realize how the tighter the world food situation gets, the more valuable land becomes.
Yeah, one of the things I remember reading was that Saudi Arabia has bought or leased land, and it turns out that the countries in Africa that are doing it are among the poorest, least nutrition-strong countries as it is.
Right. I mean, the two principal targets of land acquisitions in Africa have been Ethiopia and the Sudan. Both countries have substantial segments of their population, that is measured in the millions, who are dependent on the World Food Program for part of their food supply. So we have the political leadership in these countries with a lot of hungry people literally selling land to foreign interests, whether it be government corporations or investment bankers or whatever, making it more difficult for them to produce enough food for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And I would assume that they come in, and I would just assume they go for the best land or the best land they can purchase. I mean, this is something, again, that until I read it in this book, I had heard vaguely about it. I'd heard more, you know, China going into Africa for oil and that sort of thing. But land, I mean, this is a frightening prospect, isn't it?
It is. It's scary because what we should be doing as the food situation tightens and as climate becomes more volatile and less predictable, we should be thinking about how to build a world food bank, an international food bank, that where we would store grain, we would acquire grain when prices are down and sell it when prices reach a certain point. So it would be a stabilizing factor in the world food economy, and we should be increasing assistance to developing countries to help them realize their production potential.
Right. Right.
Instead, individual countries are going off to land on their own, and that doesn't solve the big problem, which is how do we stabilize the world market.
In all of this, you both in all of your work over the last few years, you usually, as I said in the introduction, you give a diagnosis and then a prescription, and so I certainly do want to talk about the prescription, but before switching to that, what are the other big factors that people should be paying attention to right now in terms of the diagnosis?
Well, the spreading water shortages is one. There's a tendency, particularly among economists, to look at this current surge in food prices as temporary. They'll say, "Well, you know, it's the weather in Russia last summer, and the flooding, you know, in Pakistan, and Australia, and so forth," and sort of assuming that weather was the principal culprit, and that it's likely to go back to normal. The problem is, with climate now changing, there's no norm to go back to. We don't know where it's going to go next year. It may go in one direction, it may go in another. But it's that instability that's becoming a major challenge. So that's one thing that I think we're missing badly. The second one is one we've been talking about, which is spreading water shortages as aquifers are depleted. The third is soil erosion. We're seeing some enormous dust bowls forming in the world now, two in particular, one in northern and western China and western Mongolia, one that creates dust storms that can be 1,000 miles across, which create havoc in Beijing and Seoul, Korea, and Chinese cities in the east about this time every year. Then we have another huge dust bowl forming in Central Africa, going from western Sudan and Chad all the way across through northern Nigeria to Mauritania and Senegal.
And what is the cause?
Mostly overgrazing, though overplowing and deforestation are also involved. But the world's livestock population just keeps growing and growing. And it grows in some countries even faster than the human population. So at some point, the demand for forage exceeds the sustainable yield of grasslands. And as they destroy the vegetation, the wind begins carrying the soil away, and we have dust storms and then eventually sandstorms and sand dune formation. And agriculture is finished.
So, in other words, this is if there is land that was, it was possible to do meager or sustenance agriculture, and then by this overgrazing, overworking, and so on, it becomes impossible. These huge tracts of land just go out of commission, and they're no longer a resource. Right?
That's right. The area of biologically productive land in the world is shrinking each year as a result of expanding deserts, whether it's the Sahel in Africa or the Gobi in northern China and Mongolia or any of many other deserts around the world. So that's an ongoing loss, and at some point we're going to become much more aware of that than we are today.
And some of this, a lot of what we've talked about so far, Lester, am I correct, would be so with or without climate change. If population grows and people drain an aquifer, that happens. Now, climate change may make it worse, but a lot of this was going on anyway. Climate change is the sort of the kicker to it all, right?
That's right. Water tables are falling independently of climate change. Soil erosion always happens when you destroy vegetation, and that's mostly because of overgrazing and to some degree overplowing. So yes, those trends are largely independent of the Earth's rising temperature.
Okay, now if we were to look at drill down a little bit below where these problems, the source for a lot of these problems. Obviously, population growth is one, and so on. But it's one of the huge ones that you talk about is the fact that the market does not accurately reflect the value or the cost of essential things such as food, water, et cetera. You want to speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah. Modern economics is based on very heavily on the functioning of the market. The market does a lot of things well. It allocates resources, it sets prices, et cetera, et cetera. At least it did those well for a long time. But we have now reached a point where the indirect costs of many of the things we consume are greater than the direct costs. The market is good at including the direct cost. It will include in the price of gasoline the cost of pumping the oil, of transporting it to a refinery, of refining it into gasoline, getting the gasoline to the local service station. It's good at doing that. But it is, and so the gallon of gasoline costs us $3.
$4 here in California, but there you go.
$4 now.
Yeah.
But what the market does not include are the indirect costs, such as climate change or the cost of the U.S. military presence guarding, protecting access to oil in the Middle East, for example, or the cost of treating
the health, right?
Illnesses from breathing polluted air. When you include those costs, then a price of gasoline is not $3 but $12. But we don't pay most of that. I mean, gasoline seems cheap to us, $3 or $4, not $12 or $15. And so we're kidding ourselves. The idea that gasoline is cheap or coal is cheap. They're very costly. And we have not realized yet, and that's where the market is letting us down. The market is not telling the truth.
Right. And so this is, for anyone who's listening here, this is over and above subsidies. In other words, the oil industry, the coal industry, the nuclear industry, to name three, also the corn and soy industries, but are enormously subsidized. And it strikes me that the key to subsidies is obviously not need, it's political power. And so the biggest industries, like oil and coal, have the financial wherewithal to move politicians in the directions they want, and there's the subsidies. But what we're talking about right now is over and above the subsidies are the costs that society pays. Someone pays for it, but it does not show up in the cost that the market sets for the particular entity.
That's right. It shows up in our health care costs. It shows up in climate change itself, which is becoming a factor in the world economy, and clearly a factor in driving up food prices. And sometimes you can't even calculate the cost in monetary terms because if it leads to
that's right.
The collapse of civilization, what's the price tag on that?
And short of climate change, is that other thing we call nature services, that nature supplies air purification, water purification, all sorts of services that again, are invisible and are not valued.
That's right. We're aware of the good that nature produces. Forests produce wood and fisheries produce fish and so forth. But the biggest value of the things that nature provides is fresh water, for example. It's natural processes that evaporate water from the oceans, and that water comes on land and comes down as precipitation. That's a huge resource. But we don't have to use desalting plants. Nature does that for us. Or water purification, just water moving through the ground is purified in biological terms. So we have all these services that we take for granted, but we're now beginning to interfere with some of those, and that too can be can be costly.
Now, you say in this book, I'm going to read right here. If the world is to move on to a sustainable path, we need economists who will calculate indirect costs and work with political leaders to incorporate them into market prices by restructuring taxes. And for anyone who, for instance, if you raise the tax on oil and coal and you lower the tax on income, you are then lowering, you're raising taxes on things we want less of, which is the use of oil and coal, and lowering them on things we want more of, which is people working and people hiring people. That seems to me to be one of the absolute key pivot points, that if we were to look back 25 years from now and things have turned out better than one might project today, perhaps that's what happened. But the getting from where we are today to what that sentence says, which is getting economists to calculate indirect costs and then get political leaders to incorporate them into the market. Can you see, I mean, I know it's necessary, but can you see it as possible?
Well, if we get scared enough, we do things we otherwise would not do. I mean, I go back and think of the mobilization for World War II. I mean, if you had conducted a poll on December 6, 1941, and asked the American people, should we get involved in the war or not, 95% would have said no. That was on a Saturday. If you'd waited until Monday, December 8, 1941, and asked that same question, probably 95% would have said yes. And the difference was the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, and it changed everything. And it did it quickly, but suddenly we were scared. I mean, as a country, we had been attacked in what was, in military terms, an extraordinarily successful attack that sunk a good part of the total U.S. Pacific fleet because it happened to be at anchor in Pearl Harbor. And then we mobilized, and we no longer wondered whether we should go to war or not. There was just no question. But that's the kind of the problem with a Pearl Harbor kind of wake-up call is if that comes on the climate front, it may be too late.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, in other words, I was thinking two things as you were speaking. One is, if one really looks at the information, what happened in Russia, you know, should be Exhibit A. You know, what happened in Europe 2 or 3 years ago, or throughout Europe, should be Exhibit B. You know what? It seems like the kind of news that should precipitate that kind of radical turn on a dime shift has been happening. And as you say, the kind that would actually have the impact of a Pearl Harbor may be too late because, as those who follow climate change know, this is not something that even if we change our behavior, does the result change quickly? The lag time is 30 years or so, right? In other words, we begin
decades.
So, I don't want gloom and doom. It's just this is shaky stuff. Let me finally broaden this a bit because this is the territory we're getting into now. I interview you every year or two, and I usually stick to what could broadly be defined as environmental issues. But your last few books have begun to widen out. I mean, in Plan B 4.0, the subtitle was Mobilizing to Save Civilization. In World on the Edge, it's How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. Now, as you look first at global society and then perhaps at the U.S. specifically, what are some of the key things you notice, good as well as bad, that may appear outside the realm of environment, but that really are key to whether we're going to turn things around? In other words, political, cultural, technological things and so on.
Right. Well, one of the most exciting things that's happened in this country, and indeed in the world in the last few years, has been the extraordinarily successful grassroots movement to first ban new coal-fired power plants and then to begin closing existing ones. And this has been remarkably successful. It's one of the great underreported stories on the environmental front. But if we're going to win this battle to stabilize the Earth's climate, it starts with coal. And that's exactly what this movement is doing. It's being coordinated by Sierra Club. Earth justice lawyers are waging court battles, and local groups are providing the real fire in the belly for this. And it's an extraordinary story. So that's one of the real successes we've seen. Other successes come in the renewable energy field, for example, with the enormous growth in wind energy and solar energy and increasingly geothermal energy. So things are beginning to happen. They're not happening fast enough yet and not yet on a large enough scale, but they're coming.
Okay, that's the voice of Lester Brown. He is at the Earth Policy Institute. His new book is World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse, and you can learn more at earthpolicy.org. Now let me look at just America. I have been pointing more and more lately to America's isolation, its provincialism, ultimately its ignorance, about what happens beyond our borders. The denial of science, and specifically climate change, is pretty uniquely American. And the fact that one of our two major political parties doesn't seem to actually believe in or approve of government or public service, that's pretty unique, too. I mean, Europeans, just tell me, this is crazy. Half of your political energy is against government rather than how to use government. Or, you know, I mean, like there's a certainly there are Tories in England, but they don't take the stance that folks do here. You've been at this a long, long time, and you've taken a global perspective. And we have so much influence. What do you think is going on in our culture, and how is that going to shift?
You know, I don't have a confident answer to that, but sometimes I get the feeling that people are sort of overwhelmed by the complexity. They don't understand these issues very well. I mean, when you think about climate change, we're talking about the rising concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere, a gas that you can't see, you can't taste, you can't smell. But, you know, we're told it's there. And so we're told that atmospheric CO2 concentrations over the last half century have gone from 280 parts per million to 380 parts per million. Well, that doesn't mean a lot to many people. But what that's going to translate into is rising food prices. That people do understand. And that may be where the wake-up call comes from. Maybe rising food prices will be the Pearl Harbor on the climate front.
Hmm. And let me finally, it's interesting as I was reading that there's three notions that come up that are intertwined. One is you say we need to redefine security, national security, global security, away from the military. Second, you say we need a wartime mobilization. And third, you point out that for $200 billion a year, which is less than a third of the U.S. Defense budget of $661 billion, we could begin to turn these things around. Do you have a sense that might change? I mean, for anyone who – I just looked at figures just recently. The number two spender in the world in military is China at $100 billion. Our total is $175 billion more than the spending of countries 2 through 10.
Right. No, we're in a class by ourselves. We have inherited a definition of security, of national security, from the last generation that's almost exclusively military. I meant the last century. During the last century, there were two world wars and a Cold War. And as a result of that, we've come to think of security in almost exclusively military terms. But if I were to sit down today with a clean pad and list the leading threats to our future as a country and as a global civilization even, armed aggression would not be very high on that list. The things that near the top of the list would include climate change, spreading water shortages, population growth, rising grain prices, a growing number of failing states, et cetera. I mean, armed aggression would not make the top five. It might make the top 10. But we treat it as though it were almost the only real threat to our future. And the challenge is not just to redefine security, but to reallocate resources that match the new definitions.
That's right. That's right. It isn't just to say, oh, we can cut this. It's like now recognize where that spending has to go, where that energy and that focus has to go.
And it's not a question of do we have the resources or not. We do. We just have to reallocate how we use those resources. And, I mean, the idea that we spend close to $700 billion a year for military.
Oh, by the way, I don't think that counts the two wars, so.
No. So I'm being conservative.
Exactly.
$700 billion. But the second-ranking country is China at $100 billion. I mean, they're not in the same league.
No.
You can't chart them on the same graph.
No, I have a feeling that if people took this down to some sort of a metaphor that they could look at, you know, and they saw two, you know, competing clans or something, and one clan devoted that much of its energy to the fight and no one else did, it would be obvious how ludicrous it is.
Right.
You'd think they were fools and that they'd been duped by somebody.
Yep. And we've been duped by ourselves, I think.
And even now, when we are cutting teachers and we are cutting food and aid to the disabled and the poor and so on, we are hardly touching defense on a federal level.
Right. And, I mean, we're cutting education here, there, and everywhere. And and that really is a key to our future. And so one of the things I'm pushing on is this need to redefine security and to realize that armed aggression, I mean, who's going to threaten us?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, there are people that will try to gin up some fear of China, but I think that only works if you're already in the club that believes military is what's happening.
Right, right. So anyhow, that's one of the things is to redefine security, and I think we're going to have to do that, and it may be the wake up call may come on the food front. I mean, if we have a poor harvest this year, a poor world harvest, subpar. Doesn't have to be dramatically poor, just subpar. We're going to see food prices continuing to rise, and we're going to see the consequences of rising food prices continuing to spread. And more that will translate into political instability. It will probably translate into more failing states because governments simply won't be able to provide food security, which is what people, one of the things that people
sure.
expect of their governments.
At the very basic level. Yeah, I think one of the things that I'm realizing as we conclude this conversation, Lester Brown, is that we're saying in the conversation, you know, but what's going to be scary enough? What's going to be threatening enough? And the other side of that question is, if there's a bad grain harvest, we may be able to begin to see what is scary enough.
That's right. Both in terms of its effect on us, and particularly if we find ourselves competing with the Chinese for our grain harvest. I mean, while we've been investing in military expenditures like crazy over the last decade, the Chinese have been buying treasury securities to cover the deficit that we've incurred.
That's
because
right.
of these military things.
Yeah.
And what that means, the bottom line is we're losing some of our independence and some of our freedom.
Absolutely.
We may not be able to control the use of our grain harvest in the future, and the cheap food that we have taken for granted.
Yep.
No country in the world has had cheaper food than we have may suddenly come to an end, and people are going to wonder, how did that happen?
How did we let that happen? So the book, again, is World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. The website is earthpolicy.org. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to the podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at iTunes and at TerrenceMcNally.net. TerrenceMcNally, one word, .net. And if you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, you can sign up at that website or email me at TEMcNally@mac.com. Thank you. A deep thanks to Lester Brown. Keep up your good work.
Terrence, it's been a great interview. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.